Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this state, Tuesday, December 17th, 2024. As always, we begin with today's top stories. The first headline reads, Unit 4 School Board, Banks, B-A-N-K-S, resigns seat after just over 6 months. He laments he was unable to have any meaningful impact. This article is written by Jeff D'Alessio, J-E-F-F D'Alessio, and is based out of Champaign. When Sam Banks signed up for a spot on a deeply divided Champaign school board with a pair of empty seats, he hoped to bring whatever knowledge and experience I have to getting the board and leadership's attention where it should be. That was in May, before one board member proposed publicly censuring another, before two members wrongfully accused Banks of making a play for board president, before bickering over information sharing and district policy, legal RFPs, and board reorganizing, before the tail end of this month's meeting, when frustrated board president Janina Baker said, please make me look like the angry black woman at this moment, to which fellow board member Mark Holm responded, you are. Banks didn't attend that meeting and won't be seated on the board at the next one either. 6 months and change after being appointed to the board following the resignations of two elected members, Banks himself resigned, informing the board of his decision in a letter Sunday night. The retired CEO of the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club, who didn't file to run for the seat in the April 2025 election, told the News Gazette, unfortunately, I have a family situation that requires my attention, and with the way things are with the board and me not running for election, I wanted to devote the time needed with my family. Banks referenced his resignation letter as his only other comment on the matter. In it, he struck a similar tone as Jamar Brown and Mark Tice did in their March resignation announcements, writing, in addition to a challenging personal situation, which requires my attention, it has become apparent to me that there is minimal possibility for any success and positive influence or success on impacting the unproductive dynamics between board members and the manner in which the board functions. My hope in coming on the board was to assist with moving forward with productive board operations and engagement. I regret that I'm unable to have any meaningful impact on the important work that is so needed on behalf of the students, faculty, and staff of the district. It is my hope and prayer that at some point there will be a change for the better in the current board environment. In a statement, Baker thanked Banks for stepping up to serve on the board and for his many years of service to the Champaign community, quote unquote. During his short stint of service, Banks is credited with helping broker mediation that led to a comprehensive audit of special education services that's now underway. Baker said later Monday that the board would discuss what happens next at its January meeting. It has 60 days from the date of a resignation to fill the vacancy. If it isn't able to do so, as happened when Brown and Tice resigned in March, the decision on a replacement will fall to Regional Superintendent Gary Lewis. Banks' departure, the third in 10 months, leaves the board with 6 members. 3, Baker, Vice President Heather Vasquez, and Bruce Brown, all opted not to run in April's consolidated election. Holm, appointed by Lewis, along with Banks to replace Jamar Brown and Tice, is among 11 candidates who filed for 5 seats on the ballot in April. The other 2 seats are held by Amy Armstrong and Betsy Holder, who were elected to 4-year terms in 2023. And there's one accompanying photo of that, of Mr. Banks as well, and that was just provided. Next up, Rantoul Business, longtime Bowling Alley's time, quote-unquote T-Y-M-E, has come. Company plans to turn it into a storage facility. This article is written by Dave Hinton and is based out of Rantoul. Rantoul bowlers will have to look elsewhere to participate in their favorite hobby. The former Rutgers Bowling Alley, 1568 East Grove Avenue, that's Rugers, sorry, R-U-G-E-R-S, will be turned into storage units. Brandon Moore, a partner in Sandpiper Holdings Monticello, said the company will turn the longtime bowling alley into a self-storage facility. Rantoul is underserved for storage, said Moore, a former Rantoul resident. Tenants find that they don't have enough room in their apartments or small houses. For Laura Runyon, L-O-R-A Runyon, the bowling alley represents a great deal of her life. She and her late husband, Don, owned and operated the business for 20 years, and before that she worked there for 17 years. The bowling alley was opened in 1964, and Runyon said the business originally was known as Maplewood Lanes before it was purchased by Billy and Cindy Green of Champaign. They changed the name to Billy G's Bowl. When the Runyons bought it, they changed the name to Country Time, T-Y-M-E. Laura Runyon said they chose to spell time with a Y because, according to the state of Illinois, another bowling alley in the state already used the traditional spelling of Country Time, T-I-M-E. The building is large, 32,000 square feet. I could never figure out why he made it so big, she said of the original operator who built the building. Jim Cheek, Rantoul Historical Society president, said that at one time the second floor housed a teen center. All the kids used to go out there to the bowling alley and hang out, Cheek said. We didn't do so much bowling as we did hanging out. That prompted the startup of the teen center. Laura Runyon said the second floor was eventually converted into an apartment where her grandson, Aaron, lived. Another tenant currently rents the apartment. She said the building also housed a restaurant, a bar, a snack bar, and an area to play pool. It was also the first home to Christian Life Church. Al Vogelsang, a board member of the church, said the church, which celebrated its 40th anniversary this year, spent its first 15 years renting space in the bowling alley building before moving to its current location in Rantoul. They called us the Holy Rollers, Vogelsang quipped. Laura Runyon said the bowling alley was a happening place every day. Everybody just loved it, she said. You can talk to anybody about Country Time, and it was a good place to bowl. Mike Runyon said his parents added automatic scoring and remodeled the entire place when they owned it from the rooftop to the carpet. He said the entire family worked there, including the grandsons. Whenever we sold it, we were full every night, Laura Runyon said. We had 9-pin Saturday nights, and on Sunday night, a 24-team league. She estimated she taught up to 200 youth how to bowl. At one time, Country Time hosted the youth state tournament. The 87-year-old Runyon said she continued to bowl until she was 80. I have a lot of memories. When we took it over, it was kind of a rough place. I straightened that out in a hurry because I didn't put up with that. I said, this is a family place, and you will act accordingly. People were drinking too much, and I shut them off. The Runyons eventually sold the bowling alley to Bob and Deborah Kelly of Danville. They kept the Country Time name. It closed in the spring of 2022. Aaron and Cindy Teller bought the business and said in a November 2022 News Gazette article that they plan to reopen the bowling alley in January or February of 2023. Aaron Teller has said they hope to have it renovated and to make a good old-fashioned bowling alley like it used to be. Moore is partnering with Brad Bengston on the storage unit project. We're selling all the equipment from the bowling alley and then going from there, Moore said. I don't know if we're going to use the inside of the bowling alley for the storage or not. He said storage units will be located in the parking lot. The project initially will encompass 30,000 square feet with expansions in the future. We are already working with engineers on our plans, Moore said. He said they would like to be open next spring. The bowling alley is a AMF-equipped center. This will be the second storage facility for the company, which also has one at the corner of Interstate 57 and Monticello Road in Tolono Township. The next headline reads, with a large photograph front and center, first look, Champaign Fire Department, too old to serve, ? Officials consider relocating Station 3 to a lot at Bradley and Neal. This article is written by Luke Taylor and is based out of Champaign. Champaign's oldest and smallest fire station has proved to be too old and small, but it might be a challenge to fit a larger building on the same lot. With reconstruction on the horizon for Station 3, the fire department is eyeing a lot only about half a mile from the current 702 West Bradley Avenue location. Fire Chief Andy Kornstrom said that even the small move to a city-owned lot at intersection of Bradley and Neal would make a big difference for the firefighters. It actually operationally provides for more opportunities to us because it's a major intersection. It allows our fire unit to get north, south, east, and west really easily, Kornstrom said. A quick route north brings firefighters over Interstate 74, and south brings them to downtown and the University of Illinois campus, where that station is called to occasionally. The fire department and the city are now looking to the community to share thoughts and feelings about the proposed location. One community discussion is scheduled for 6 p.m. Thursday at the Stratton Academy of the Arts. Kornstrom said that there will also most likely be a discussion on Wednesday, but details are currently up in the air. The time and place will be posted on the Champaign Fire Department's Facebook and X accounts once finalized. This decision to relocate comes after the fire department got approval to begin planning a replacement for the station in the first place. The current building was constructed in 1957 and is only about 1,000 square feet. It had a pretty hard life at 60 plus years old, Kornstrom said. Modern technology for firefighters has evolved a lot. The small building actually creates some safety and sanitation issues. Kornstrom said that now fire stations have a dirty side and a clean side, so that when firefighters return from a call, they can remove their gear on their dirty side, wash it, and shower so as not to contaminate the clean side with any toxins. A new fire station, which would likely be about 10,000 square feet, would also likely have training rooms, community rooms, workout space, and other amenities that are common in fire stations now, but weren't in the 1950s. All of those details are currently being hashed out since the new station is in the design phase during fiscal year 2024 and 2025. Kornstrom said that if city funding is available, the new station could be completed as of 2027, but that's assuming everything lines up perfectly. One advantage to choosing a new location, even if it isn't the Bradley and Neal intersection, would be that the fire department wouldn't need to find a place to house firefighters and equipment from that location while construction takes place. Kornstrom said he doesn't anticipate any major objections from the community about the location currently being considered, but these meetings will be the first time people are asked for feedback. It's too early to say what will become of the old station after this process is completed, but Kornstrom said he could see it becoming an office building for fire marshals or having a public education purpose. Either way, he predicts it will need a fair amount of remodeling before being repurposed. And there's a large photograph that accompanies this article. It's an exterior photo of the small firehouse with a police car in front of it and an American flag pole right in front of the building. The caption reads, Champaign Fire Station 3 at 702 West Bradley Avenue, Champaign, has been deemed too old and small to continue serving its purpose. And that photo is provided by Robin Scholes of the News Gazette. The next headline reads from Bob Asmussen, UI Foundation President, celebrating Hall Call. When he first took over as the University of Illinois Foundation President and CEO, Jim Moore, M-O-O-R-E, was asked the usual question for Champaign-Urbana newcomers, Cubs or Cardinals. His answer, White Sox. For the 59-year-old Moore, the White Sox have always been his team and for a very good reason. His uncle, Dick Allen, kids in the family called him Richie, starred for Chicago's American League team. In 1972, Allen was the toast of baseball, hitting .308 with 37 homers and 113 RBI to earn AL MVP honors. The White Sox finished 87-67 and in second behind eventual World Series champion Oakland. Chicago had a better record than East winner Detroit. But no wild card those days, so fans didn't get to see the amazing Allen in the playoffs. An even bigger moment for the Allen family, that's A-L-L-E-N, family, came earlier this month on December 8th when the 7-time MLB All-Star was selected for the Baseball Hall of Fame. Allen was picked by the Classic Baseball Era Committee along with the great Dave Parker. They will be enshrined on July 7th in Cooperstown, New York. Expected to see the place full of Allen's family and friends, or expect to see the place full of Allen's family and friends. They have long pushed for Allen's induction after a career that closed with 351 homers and MVP and Rookie of the Year honors. The push for Allen to reach the Hall of Fame was led by his son, Dick Allen Jr. Sadly, Dick Allen Sr. passed away in 2020 at the age of 78. Check out the YouTube video of announcement that Dick Allen had been selected, which set off a celebration for his family. I was just so pleased for my cousin Dick and his family and all of the Allens to finally see Uncle Rich get the proper acknowledgement that he so richly deserved, Moore said. That emotion in that video said it all. It was really special. Now Moore has a relative in Cooperstown. How cool is that? It wipes away the disappointment of previous votes when Allen didn't make it. He clearly has the numbers, Moore said. It's been frustrating. In 2020, the Phillies retired Allen's number 15. Moore has been there to take a picture. I thought that was so special, Moore said. Getting to know him. Moore remembers spending time as a kid with Uncle Richie in Percasi, Pennsylvania. That's where Allen had a farm and raised horses. He was a great guy, Moore said. I actually have one of his bats at my house here in Champaign-Urbana, and one from the 60s that says Rich Allen on it. Moore enjoyed the stories from Uncle Richie. His passion for baseball and horses was unparalleled, Moore said. The guy was just a student of the game and ahead of his time in that regard as a hitter. Allen talked about some of the characters he knew in baseball. In his era, there were plenty of them. When he talked about his sport, Allen had Moore's attention. It was always fascinating to me to hear him describe somebody was going to hit a baseball, Moore said. He could watch you swing a bat and dissect your ability in a few swings. One time, Moore was with Allen in Tucson, Arizona, at a batting cage. Members of the University of Arizona baseball team, a college power, were there too. He started just watching them swing and talking about how this one can't hit a fastball and this one's going to be able to pull the ball. Moore remembers his dad, James, yucking it up with Allen. Moore is old enough to have seen his uncle at the height of his talent. I remember those great years with the White Sox, Moore said. I wore number 15 because he wore number 15. When the Moore family lived in Arizona, Allen would visit regularly. Allen spent 3 seasons with the White Sox, hitting 85 homers and driving in 242 runs. He returned to the Phillies in 1975 for 2 seasons. Philadelphia is where the former basketball All-Stater got his start in 1963. There were great times in Philly for Allen, including a monster 40-homer, 110 RBI 1966 season. But shocker, the fans in Philadelphia turned on Allen and he eventually asked to be traded. In parts of 15 seasons, Allen played for 4 teams, including 2 stints with the Phillies. He is credited with mentoring another Hall of Famer, Mike Schmidt. Origin story. Moore is in his 10th year as U of I Foundation president after serving for a decade in the same capacity at the University of Arizona. Moore, who celebrated his birthday Monday, is a central Pennsylvania native who spent his early years in Tucson. He is a graduate of Northwest Missouri State University in Maryville, Maryland, or Montana, that's MO, where he played football. He earned his master's from Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York. Moore and wife Shelley have 3 adult children. That's Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-I. Bob Asmussen is a college football reporter and columnist for the News Gazette. He can be reached by phone or email. His phone number is 217-393-8248. That's 217-393-8248. And his email address is Asmussen, A-S-M-U-S-S-E-N, at newsgazette.com. And there are 2 photos that accompany this article. One is of Jim Moore and his wife, Shelley. It looks like they're at a game. White Sox game. They took a selfie with the field behind them, and that photo is provided. And then there's another photo outside with an image of a baseball player on the side of a truck. The caption reads, "Family members and friends of Philly's great Dick Allen joined city officials at the unveiling of a mural in his honor." That mural is just up against the truck, I guess, and not on it. And there's people kind of waving in front of it and just celebrating the fact that it was created. And that photo is provided by the Tribune News Service. Next up, top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Two of Champaign-Urbana's holiday traditions played out over the weekend: the opening of Candlestick Lane in Urbana and luminaries lighting up South Willis Avenue in Champaign. The latter took place on Sunday night as neighbors from Springfield Avenue to John Street lined their sidewalks with candles and bags. Longtime readers of the News Gazette were quick to let us know it's been going on a lot longer than the 31 years we mentioned in previous stories. Janet Ropner, who grew up at 506 South Willis, said her late father had a hand in growing it in the early 1960s. Ron Sterkel, who taught graphic design at the University of Illinois, supplied bags of sand and left the rest to his neighbors. "Back then we did it on Christmas Eve," said Ropner, now living in Centerville, Ohio. Elizabeth White, a 1975 Champaign Central grad living in Dunedin, Florida, also checked in after liking our social media posts. Growing up at 514 South Willis, she said she was happy the tradition continues some 60 years after she took part in it. "When I was a kid, it was just kind of magical," she said. "We looked forward to it every year." Have a neighborhood tradition to spotlight? You can always email Jim Rosso at his email address, which is jrossow@newsgazette.com. And there's a photograph that accompanies this article. It's a photo of a sidewalk that's just stretched out in front of you with the lights illuminated kind of in the darkness on the path. It's very pretty. And that photo is provided by Jim Rosso for the News Gazette. Next up, history. Area history. In 1924, Charles A. Carroll, C-A-R-R-O-L-L, who made brick for the first building erected on the University of Illinois campus, who often saw Abraham Lincoln and who helped convert Champaign County from a prairie swampland to the fertile district it is today, died at his home as a result of a stroke. In 1974, the University of Illinois administration is investigating two separate incidents of alleged hazing by campus fraternities. Hugh Satterley, vice chancellor for campus affairs, said the incidents told to him involved physical hazing, where the possibility of bodily harm existed. He would not reveal the names of the fraternities involved. And in 2009, developer Jeff Molander said he hopes to put 10 to 12 loft apartments and possibly more in the sports publishing building on North Neal Street in Champaign. International history, today's highlight. On December 17, 1903, Wilbur and Orville Wright of Dayton, Ohio, conducted the first successful manned powered airplane flights near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, using their experimental craft, the Wright Flyer, W-R-I-G-H-T Flyer. In 1933, in the inaugural NFL championship football game, the Chicago Bears defeated the New York Giants 23-21 at Wrigley Field. In 1944, the U.S. Army's Western Defense Command rescinded orders to incarcerate people of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast during World War II. More than 110,000 men, women, and children of Japanese ancestry, about two-thirds of whom were American citizens, had been forced into camps and held by armed guards following a February 1942 executive order by President Franklin Roosevelt. In 1975, Lynette, or Squeaky Frome, was sentenced in Sacramento, California, to life in prison for her attempt on the life of President Gerald R. Ford, She was paroled in August of 2009. In 1979, Arthur McDuffie, a black insurance broker and former Marine, was beaten by police after leading them on a chase with his motorcycle in Miami. McDuff died in a hospital 4 days later. Four white police officers accused of beating McDuff were acquitted the following year, sparking riots in the city that led to several deaths and millions of dollars in damages. The next headline reads, Champaign Park District, just a couple weeks of festive fun before the Virginia goes dark. This article is written by Jana Wiersema and is based out of Champaign. The Virginia Theater plans to end 2024 with a bang before going dark for 3.5 months. The final event before the theater closes for fly system control upgrades will be the Mannheim Steamroller Christmas by Chip Davis at 6 p.m. December 29th, said Virginia Executive Director Stephen, S-T-E-V-E-N, Bentz, B-E-N-T-Z. The program marks 35 years since the group's first Christmas album and will include dazzling multimedia effects, the Virginia's website states. That's a big show, Bentz said. It's three trucks and buses and lots of people on stage, lots of technology. They have a big video wall they bring in. It's basically an arena show. The concert is always fun and is a popular holiday event, he said. Other upcoming events at the Virginia include Meet Santa at the Virginia Theater from 5 to 7 p.m. today and Wednesday. Sign-ups for both nights were full as of Monday morning, though there is the possibility a reservation slot might open up if a family's plans change. The Virginia also has some private events scheduled for the remainder of the month. This time of year, those typically include school trips, corporate events, holiday events, and University of Illinois convocations, Bentz said. Once the new year rings in, it'll be time to close the doors and get down to business. We close right at the top of January, he said. The plan is to be done with the project on April 18th, just in time to reopen for Ebert Fest. The film festival is slated for April 23rd through 26th. When asked about the effect of the closure on staff, Bentz said the theater has a small team, including himself, four managers, and a handful of part-time employees who man concessions and box office sales. Almost everything else is handled by volunteers, though there are also stagehands from the local union who work on productions. He expects part-time staff to be most affected by the closure and noted that it will also be a big change for volunteers who dedicate a lot of time in the theater. For Bentz and the management staff, the closure will be a time to focus on preparing for the busy season ahead. He added that the box office will still be open during this time, though likely with reduced hours of 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. There will be shows that are put on sale during that period, he said. There will be shows that are added to the calendar during that period as well, so it'll still be very much an active space for announcements, just not actually hosting any shows. The fly system control upgrades won't be the only work going on during the Virginia's closure. The Champaign Park District Board voted Wednesday to approve an $84,080.27 contract with Hart Technologies to install access control upgrades at the theater, said CPD Executive Director Sarah Sandquist. Bentz said the work is part of an ongoing effort to update security across the park district. He added that while the Virginia was originally scheduled to receive these upgrades during the next fiscal year, the park district wants to maximize the time the theater is closed. The sad part of going dark is that there were several events they had to turn down, Bentz said. There's some pain, but there's a lot of gain from having this fly system upgrade addressed, he said. And I think the theater will be more competitive than it ever has been. I'm Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, December 17th, 2024. Thank you for listening. It's always a pleasure to read with you. I'll be back with part two of the News Gazette for today in just a moment. Stay with me.